I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. The star of the month, of course, is the turkey. Think you know much about turkeys? Well, we will find out. Mark Faraday, science coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary, is here to talk turkey and other bird and wildlife news. Good morning.
Good morning, Mindy.
There they are. But you know, that's what you think. You would think. All right, stop that, turkeys. You would think that
settle down,
gobble, 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 gobble is the only noise they make. But in fact, they make a ton of other noises.
They do make a ton of other noises. This segment is against my will, for the record. This was my idea. Yes.
Well, you know what? Because I was really surprised about something. There are, I'm not even going to play all of them because there's way too many. But let's see. The assembly call. This is the adult hen assembly call. I guess they're saying, come on, let's get together and do what turkeys do. Have you heard that? Would you think that was a turkey?
Well, yeah. I mean, I am familiar with these calls because I have turkeys that literally knock on my window at my office. Like, I turn around, there's just turkeys always.
Yeah, yeah.
They jog. They're very fitness-oriented, the turkeys at the sanctuary. They literally jog back and forth by my window. Between the feeders and the big field there at the sanctuary. So I hear a lot of their little noises, the quiet little sounds they make when they have the young, the sounds the males make when they're squabbling. But, you know, the people who really know the turkey sounds are the turkey hunters.
Of course.
And they have them all cataloged, and they have various ways of imitating them. But turkey hunters are basically pretending to be turkeys. That's what the success. They're very difficult to hunt.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, they seem like they're not so bright. You know, they're just walking around downtown areas. Well,
they know
they're pretty
the
smart. They're not going to get hunted, and they can't.
Wow.
They know the hunting regulations. They can't get shot in a downtown area.
All right, so those turkeys that are wandering under your window trying to get your attention, they probably give you the cluck. Then this is the sound that's used to get the attention of another.
Sometimes they don't give a cluck.
It sounds like Mark. Mark.
They knock on my window when they really want my attention.
Then we have the excited yelp. And according to this wild turkey sounds, this is not because they're in danger. This is because they're worked up about something. They're actually excited.
Oh, they're psyched.
Yeah, they're psyched about something.
Yeah.
This is my favorite.
We filled the bird feeders. That's,
yes.
You know, they're excited.
I really like this one, purring. Did you know turkeys purr?
Yes. This is what I hear most often out my window.
That's actually kind of nice.
It is. It's pretty cute. Yeah. You have to be close to them. This sound doesn't carry, but they, like I said, they're always outside my window. And they're often giving these little purrs. It's an endearing sound.
Okay, we've talked about this before, but you know there are people saying, why are there so many turkeys? I don't remember all of these turkeys, you mm-hmm. know, 10, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
So what happened?
Well, we brought them here. We we brought this upon ourselves.
Yeah.
So Mass wildlife biologists reintroduced turkeys to Cape Cod in 1993. With stock taken from New York and Western Mass, where there were still relatively healthy populations. I mean, they'd basically been hunted out for Massachusetts pretty much altogether and had to be reintroduced kind of bit by bit. And we got ours in 1993, and they've just been on the increase ever since. There wasn't a lot of hunting pressure. It was only in the last few years that they added, I always forget, there's a spring and a fall season. And they just added the second season pretty recently for Cape Cod. So there really isn't a ton of hunting pressure out here. And they've just grown and grown and grown. And there's lots of bird feeders and, good habitat. A lot of pine oak woods are really good for them. Lots of acorns for them. We've had a lot of good acorn years. And they do very well. I mean, I've seen flocks of over 60 in the winter in East Ham.
There seems to be a lot in East Ham. I think it might be.
They had them
biggest turkey population.
They had them many years before we had them at the sanctuary. So here we are, a bird sanctuary, right? Audubon birds. You'd think we would have gotten turkeys relatively soon, but they were way out in Truro and Provincetown for years before we ever saw one at the sanctuary. Mm. But once they got there, they haven't left.
Yeah.
You know, they're just sort of there.
When they're comic relief. They're going to stick around.
Yeah.
866-999-4626 is our number if you have a bird question. You want to talk turkey with us. 866-999-4626. 1-800-799-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. A couple of turkey facts I uncovered in my research here.
All right.
All right. An adult turkey has 5,000 to 6,000 feathers. Is that unusual? Is that like most birds? I mean, I rarely count the feathers
on birds I look at.
I don't know if that's a lot or not.
I don't either.
All right. Turkey droppings tell a bird's sex and age.
Okay.
The male's droppings are J-shaped, the female droppings are spiral, and the larger the diameter, the older the bird. So now you know when you've got a turkey, you can tell how old and what's hanging out in your yard.
I'll get right on that. Some crappy research produced those results, I think.
Yeah. Well, we could go on and on, but we'll leave it there.
That's enough turkey talk.
But the turkeys that these wild turkeys that we're hunting here, they're not the same thing like the turkeys you find in the grocery store, though, right? Are they the same thing?
No.
I mean,
the domestic ones are different. They've been isolated for, I mean, they're basically the same thing. They can interbreed. And sometimes people are constantly showing me pictures of a turkey kind of mixed in with the wild turkeys in their neighborhood that's white or partly white. And the question is always, is it a partial albino, like a naturally occurring partial albino, or does it have some domestic stock? Because domestic turkeys are white. And they live in barnyards, and we know what their fate is.
Mm.
But I think they will get out occasionally, and they can interbreed with wild turkeys. But certainly, they're very, very closely related.
Well, if you were a domestic turkey, wouldn't you want to get out? Yeah, and join those wild turkeys.
Yes, that would be my first priority.
A better future. And then we also have sometimes issues with the turkeys being aggressive. Are these usually the male turkeys, or could it be the female turkeys too? It's usually the males.
It seems
right?
like it's the males. Yeah, chasing mailmen and all kinds
and
of great stories.
What is it
stories.
About mailmen that they? Why do they? You know,
I don't
it always
know,
seems to
animals.
Be the mail trucks and the.
Yeah. I was what's called a casual carrier for a while back in my 20s. It was a job I had for the winter in Brockton, where I grew up, where I was a mailman. I had a route, I had a half route, and most of my problems involved Rottweilers and pit bulls. But I never encountered. We didn't have wild turkeys in Brockton at that point. But there's lots of stories of turkeys going after mailmen. They just don't. Just animals don't like mailmen. I don't know what it is.
Maybe it's uniforms. I don't know. Maybe I don't know. But you never hear them going after the UPS guy.
Yeah,
right?
That's a good point. I think they're in and out so quick.
Yeah,
they get those big imposing trucks.
866-999-4626 is our number this morning. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Right, so we are having a little bit less daylight and wondering, how does that impact bird behavior? We set the clocks back and then forward in the spring. Yeah. The bird, they don't have clocks, right? So
right. You know, they get seasonal affective disorder this time of year. It's really sad. Moping about.
Yeah.
So there are a couple of ways that daylight length is important to birds. The first way is that it tells them when to migrate. Certain species, particularly short-distance migrants that kind of stay within the hemisphere, they stay north of the equator or stay within North America. They respond to day length, and that tells them when it's time to migrate. They're not responding to temperature. Oh, it's getting cold. It's time to migrate. It's day length through their endocrine system kind of gives them the nudge that it's time to migrate. For those that stick around, non-migratory birds, the sort of common sense way that day length impacts them is as it gets shorter, they don't have as much time to feed during the day. And so at the same time, it's getting colder. So when the day length is really short and it's really cold, that's when day length is really impacting them, because something like a chickadee has to consume a ton of calories. In order to survive that night, if it's going to be a freezing night, they have to eat tons of food during a winter day. And they can't forage in the dark. And so short day length is a constraint on how far north certain species can go. It's a very real physiological constraint because it limits how much food they can eat in a day, which then interacts with temperature to limit how well they can survive the night on a really cold night. So that's the kind of thing that limits how far north certain species can winter. Things like Carolina wrens have been shifting north, but a really cold, snowy winter can knock them back because they don't migrate.
Yeah, we see Carolina wrens. I see them in the winter around here.
That's right. They don't. That's what I'm saying. They don't migrate.
Yeah,
and
at
so
all.
At all. And so that's why they are impacted by things like day length and temperature interacting. Because if they can't get enough food to survive a really cold night, then that can they can perish, and that can knock back their population.
So this is why the bird feeders come in handy, then.
Yeah, yeah. It's some of these birds. It does come in handy for them. Yeah, it helps, can help them survive the night.
Anytime you got a snowstorm, you know, coming or about around that time, boy, look at those feeders. They go crazy.
Oh, yeah. No, activity goes way up. They know. I mean, they need to eat more. They're strongly driven to just eat when they know they have to survive a really cold night.
You almost wonder if they have, like, I don't know, some kind of instinct on this, because all of a sudden the bird feeders will be crazy and you're like, okay, what's coming?
Absolutely.
Something's coming.
Yeah, whether it's sensing the low pressure
right.
that tends to bring in bad weather. they definitely seem to know things we don't. They sense the world in various ways that we don't understand. They see in a different light spectrum, and they just can sense the electromagnetic fields. And, you know, birds just interact with the environment in ways that we can barely understand. It's one of the reasons they're so fascinating.
Because we need to watch them and
Absolutely.
Learn a lot from our little bird friends. All right. So we've talked about this before, too, but it's worth mentioning again. The yard cleanup. I haven't cleaned up my yard yet, and I don't think I'm going to.
Good for you.
Because I hadn't really thought about this, but, you know, aside from the birds, there's all kinds of little, like, insects and things, right, that
right.
can live in all that, the leaves that have come down. And who knows how many butterflies we might be killing by raking up all those leaves and scrub and stuff on the ground.
That's right. It's mostly moths that are in the leaf litter. There's lots of moths that they pupate. So the caterpillar, you know, forms their cocoon. They'll do that in the soil or in leaf litter. That's really common for a lot of different kinds of moths. And so, you know, having too clean of a yard definitely will limit the biodiversity in your yard. And by limiting the insects, that limits the food for your birds and so on and so forth. So, you know, leave some seed heads, your perennials and annuals. Especially things in the daisy family, goldenrods, things like that. You know, that's food for sparrows and goldfinches and things. Leave the leaf litter, like you said, for places for insects to overwinter. And so something like a Carolina wren, there and other birds that hang out on the ground that are trying to overwinter successfully, they're flipping through that leaf litter looking for cocoons and things. And that's what gets them through the winter. You know, a lot of these birds that are year-round are actually insectivorous. They're not eating, you know, surviving on bird seed or seeds. They're actually finding those stages of insects that we don't think about that are overwintering. And so whether it's eggs or larva or a pupa, there are various stages of insects that are how they overwinter, and the birds find those. You know, chickadees are finding spider eggs and, you know, all kinds of
Have
pupae.
All the spider eggs you like.
Yeah. See, they're doing a service.
So, you know, one year I found a swallowtail caterpillar in my parsley. But you know, obviously the parsley dies back and it's gone. So where are they? Where are they hanging out?
Black swallowtail. So they different butterflies overwinter in different stages. The black swallowtail overwinters in a pupa. So they're and then they'll emerge as an adult butterfly. I'd have to check
so
into this.
In the ground?
No, they'd probably be
hanging from something. Okay.
Yeah, like a monarch.
Yeah,
A lot of the butterflies will hang off of vegetation and then pupate. There are a lot of moths that like to go into the ground, but it varies. You know, there are moths that like to pupate hanging from branches as well. I mean, there are so many different kinds of moths, way more than butterflies.
Okay. Yeah. So for my neighbors who heard me say I'm not going to clean up the yard, I'll keep it in the back without the gardens. We'll rake the front so that leaves don't blow in your yard.
Yeah. Don't call the town just yet.
866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. The email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking bird news with Mark Faraday, science coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. 866-999-4626 is our number for your bird questions, stories, comments. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And Ernie is giving us a call from Nantucket. Hi, Ernie.
Hi. Hi, Mark.
Hey, Ernie. How's it going?
Oh, good. Hey, I wanted to ask you about the possible impact of these genetically altered mice that they're talking about introducing on Nantucket and perhaps some other islands on predators that might eat these mice. Since these mice are going to be modified with other mouse genes, they're still going to be 100% white-footed mouse. But I've heard people express concern that, oh, it's a GMO organism, and we don't know what effect that might have on predators that eat these things. Hmm. I know you're not a avian physiologist, but do you have any thoughts on that topic?
Oh, I'll pretend to be any kind of expert I need to, you know. This is live radio. My immediate reaction to that is there would be no danger at all. I mean, you know, it'd be like worrying about that we're slowly all turning into chickens because we're eating chickens. You're not incorporating the genetic material of the things you eat. You're not slowly becoming a cow because you eat a lot of hamburgers. The only concern would be, and I don't think this is the case, if somehow the mice had been genetically engineered to produce some toxin or something like that, but I don't think that's the case. It's not something I would be especially concerned about.
No, my understanding is they're being, altered to have antibodies against the Lyme disease vector.
Right.
And antibodies are just the protein, which, you know, we routinely and birds routinely digest every day.
That's exactly right. It's right. There's no, these hawks or whatever is eating these mice are not going to be incorporating that genetic material. Only if they somehow coded the mice to produce some harmful chemical or something like that, which is not the case at all. It's simply an immune, kind of a tweaking of the immune system to reduce Lyme disease. And I haven't looked into it a ton, but it seems like a pretty inventive way to go about this, and I'm curious to follow it as it goes forward.
Yeah, Ernie, thanks for the call and the question. Appreciate that. John is giving us a call from thanks. John is giving us a call from Chatham. Hi, John.
Hello, ma'am.
Hi, John.
Hello. A couple of years ago, I was lucky enough to get a picture of a long-eared owl, and I was wondering, what are the chances of the snowy owls returning this year to Cape Cod?
What a great question.
Good lead-in. I remember that long-eared owl you're talking about, John. That was really something. They've returned, or one has. Actually, just breaking news from Facebook last night, so how we learn about everything in the world these days. But a couple of birders, Sue Finnegan and John Pratt, they're really active birders here on the Cape, and they found one at First Encounter Beach in Eastham yesterday. I'm a little reluctant to put that out there because I'm just afraid.
But it's Sue Finnegan.
The crowds.
So,
No. Oh. I mean, they have a picture of it. It's a beautiful.
It looked like
a male.
Okay, yeah.
Very, very white bird.
You don't want people to go scared.
Yeah, it's just what happened at West Dennis Beach a few years ago. It was just people were just trampling the dunes and just getting way too close to the owls. And just stay on the road and don't, you know, if you go look for snowy owls and, you know, just kind of gauge their behavior. And if you feel like they're aware of you and being disturbed by you, then back off. More often than not, they're fine. I mean, these birds are pretty mellow. Like a lot of Arctic creatures, they just, they seem to be pretty calm around people, but just don't be trampling off trail and things like that to get photos of them. That's why I say I'm reluctant to put that information out there. But start
it's
checking.
Moved on. It's gone.
Yeah, it's gone. But just start checking your local barrier beaches. That's where they turn up first. And when those habitats fill up, they can turn up just about anywhere. But really, in a normal year, the first snowy owls to turn up will occupy the primo habitats, which is a barrier beach where there's ducks. So they like to sit at the tip of a barrier beach, particularly a remote one like Jeremy Point in Wellfleet. There's a snowy owl out there almost every year. You know, boaters aren't getting out there in the winter, so they're relatively unmolested out there, and there's tons of ducks. And so what these owls do is they go out at night. Even though we see them during the day, they're mostly nocturnal. And from satellite tracking studies, they show that these owls go out at night, fly out over the water, and they're hunting ducks. So these poor sleeping ducks, they're just, you know, and they're grabbing big ducks, common eiders, like the heaviest duck in North America. And they're grabbing these off the water, dragging them back to shore, and having them for breakfast. They eat a lot of buffalheads, which is more of a snack, these little cute little buffalheads.
Cute little,
so.
Yeah.
you know, nature eats other nature. That's how that's how it works out there. Yeah. So we love the snowy owls and we love the ducks. But
very pretty. Yeah, John, thanks for the phone call. Now, remember a few years back we had tons of snowy owls, especially on Nantucket. Remember we had all those because they had such a big...
Oh, everywhere, yeah.
Yeah, they had that big lemming population where they breed. Do we know
exactly
what we had this year?
And so that was a good opportunity to dispel the myth that the owls are starving. This was always the conventional wisdom or lack of wisdom was that, the owls are starving and they're coming down here, leave them alone. But Norm Smith is Mass Audubon's snowy owl expert and really one of the world's snowy owl experts. He's banded tons of them, and he finds that they're healthy when, he traps them mostly at Logan Airport, where mm-hmm. he has a contract to do that on behalf of Massport. And they're mostly healthy and strong. And so the big influx year was not a result of food shortages, but a result of a bumper crop of lemmings producing tons and tons of chicks in parts of northern Quebec, I believe it was. Mm. And so the owls were so productive that they just sort of they ran out of real estate
and spread out.
Had to head south. And
yeah.
In a year with fewer birds, most of them will, believe it or not, stay in the Arctic for the winter. I mean, just imagine how tough these birds are. Mm. I mean, there's no light. I mean, it's just permanent darkness, and they're sitting on an ice floe in the Arctic Ocean somewhere, picking off sea ducks, and that's how they survive the winter. And that's what most snowy owls do in any given year, because typically they don't come south. And so these are just unbelievably tough birds.
Yeah, sounds
and
like it.
Just, I love it when they come down. It's just
they're
a little
so
bit,
beautiful,
little
yeah.
bit of the Arctic in your backyard. It's just the face of the Arctic that you can see.
I'm
at
probably
your local
not
beach.
Getting up to the Arctic to see them there. So
yeah, why not?
Right. Susan's sent us an email. She says, "I've made friends with some turkeys in Wellfleet. One of the larger birds has a plume-like feather coming from mid-chest, about 8 to 10 inches or longer. What's up with that?"
Most of them probably have that. That's the beard, and both sexes can have it, though it's mostly the males that have it. And they're just specialized weird feathers, and they sort of hang off the chest. And I think they get longer with age, kind of like the spur. Mm. The males have a spur on the back of their legs, kind of down by the foot, that they use to fight. And the length of that spur can tell you how old the males are. The beards are the same thing. Some, like I said, some females can have those beards, but it's not really clear, what's it for? I have absolutely no idea. Only the turkeys know.
Maybe it's decor. They look
it's
better.
It's decor, yeah. Yeah, they're foppish birds.
Yes, yes. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Interesting article in Audubon about sooty feathers. Sooty feathers tell the history of pollution in American cities. This was with pictures. This was fascinating.
Yeah, this was this caught my eye. It was National Audubon's magazine, Audubon, and it was a study using museum specimens. And this is one of the examples of how museum skins, these kind of dead birds that sit in drawers in places like the Harvard Museum of Comparative Zoology for years and years, how they can be useful for research really kind of forever, as long as they exist. And so some researchers went back. They started at the Field Museum in Chicago, where there's something like 500,000 specimens with data on them. And a lot of these specimens, they go back to the 19th century. They go back to the mid-1800s and beyond, and all the way up through now. And they were noticing that during certain periods, the birds had sooty feathers. And so with a little bit of thinking, they realized that this probably had something to do with the Industrial Revolution, mm-hmm. when cities like Chicago were just, factory after factory was being built and they're just belching out smoke. There were no air pollution regulations whatsoever. People were covered in soot. And so they laid out these different specimens. They picked birds with white underparts. It really showed. There's a nice picture in here of horned larks showing very clearly several horned larks that look like they came out of a chimney. Mm. They're just kind of coal gray, and they should be all white. So it's just kind of this interesting picture of the American Industrial Revolution painted in feathers. And they could even detect some fine-scale things like early environmental regulations. And then there was, I think in 1955, there was one of the early clean air regulations. And then it started to go away. They started to be whiter up through the Clean Air Act. And so, you know, the birds were white again. So yeah. Just a really interesting picture of our industrial revolution and our country pre-environmental regulations and just how severe the pollution was in the early days.
Yeah, and how, where we're going, right? I mean, you can because they go, like it was 1880 to 2015 the specimens were collected or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
Right, and they've been relatively clean since the 50s and especially since the Clean Air Act, which was what, in the 70s?
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean we're doing a lot better. There are other things to worry about these days. We're not choking on soot like we were at the turn of the 20th century, but you know, we've got other issues now.
866-999-4626 is our number for your bird comments, questions or stories. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, reverse migration of warblers and flycatchers. What's that all about?
Yeah, so that's something that has been really conspicuous the last month, I'd say. So, you know, we know birds fly south for the winter. Certain birds, you know, are warblers and flycatchers and things. These are what we call neotropical migrants. So they withdraw from their breeding range in Canada, you know, northern United States, and go to Central America or the Caribbean or South America. So, you know, some of these completely leave North America for the winter to go to Central and South America. And so, you know, they're passing through here in September, early October, with the goal of getting to Costa Rica or Colombia pretty quickly. But there's a weather phenomenon that can happen, especially off the southeastern coast of the United States, that traps them in a northbound flow of air, and though they're leaving Florida, trying to get to the Caribbean or Central America or South America, they get caught up in this northerly flow off the coast of Florida, and they find themselves right back in New England a couple days later. And you can imagine, you know, a bird has a limited amount of energy. They need to get, you know, they can't survive the winter here. They need to get to somewhere tropical. And all of a sudden, they're back in, you know, Cape Cod in late October when they should be in Guatemala.
Right.
And so this is pretty stressful on these birds. And there are a lot of them out there. Birders have been turning up warblers that should be long gone by mid-October, late October, never mind November. People are turning up things like northern Perula. We banded a magnolia warbler at our banding station at the sanctuary within the last few days. Magnolia warblers are definitely not a bird you should be seeing in November. Eastern wood pewees that they go to Central and South America. I saw a wood pewee in Peru like a week ago. That's where they should be. But they got caught up in this this northerly flow off of Florida and ended up back here. And so the question is, what happens to them?
What's going to happen to them?
Who knows?
We don't know.
Right? They have to migrate again. So they may have to stay for a while and try to fatten up, hope that the weather's mild enough that they can fatten up. There's still enough insects, you know, because these are insectivorous birds, and that they can build up enough fat reserves to be able to migrate again. Because that's a very energetically taxing thing to migrate from New England to, you know, Brazil or
right.
Colombia. And so they would need to get up to a certain kind of fighting weight in order to be able to do that again. So I think my prediction is that the Christmas bird counts in December will be turning up some interesting warblers and things that weren't able to get up to wait or, you know, whatever survives until then.
Yeah. See how tough it is to be a bird?
It's really tough to be a bird, yeah.
Kathy's giving us a call from Orleans. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. I have two questions. You only need to answer one of them. I'm going to Alaska in July, and I'd like to know what birds I should be especially on the lookout for, the inside passage up to Denali. And then the other question is, how big an impact is the opening up the Alaska refuge to drilling? going to be? It seems huge, and what can we do about it?
So I have the option of only answering one of those
questions.
You're
answering both of those questions.
All right. The boss said I have to answer both questions. In terms of, there's all kinds of birds up there. So you're doing a cruise?
I am, and then we'll be on land once we get to Denali.
Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of the shorebirds that we only see in migration breed up there. Lots of ducks, interesting eiders that we don't typically see, like king eiders and spectacled eiders and things like that. Incredible seabirds like the auks, meaning like we have razorbills around here and sometimes murres and very rarely puffins. So that part of Alaska is really rich in auk species. All kinds of crazy auklets and murrelets and things that you can see there. Different kinds of kittiwake, like red-legged kittiwakes. There are a lot of birds. Alaska is really rich in July with birds, with species that birders love to see, and they travel there specifically to see. So there are all kinds of things that you could potentially see up there.
So Kathy's going at a good time.
Yeah, and I've never birded Alaska. It's one of my
one
of my great shames.
Oh dear!
I came close to working there a couple of times, but mainly I've worked in the southern part of the U.S. and other places, and I never got up to Alaska to work on bird research, and I do regret that. But I'll get there one of these days.
Yeah, Kathy, I know July is a long way off, but I hope after your trip you'll call in and we do this show once a month and let us know what you discovered when you're there. We'd love to hear that.
Thank you. I will.
All right. Second question, Mark.
Great.
So the second question was about drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. I mean, there'll be immediate acute environmental impacts in terms of building roads and drilling pads and the potential for spills and all that kind of logical stuff that would impact animals in the immediate area. You know, there's concern about the porcupine caribou herd. But, you know, and then there are also the concerns about, you know, more fossil fuels and the climate change impacts of burning more fossil fuels. So, yeah, it's not a great thing. It's something that environmental organizations have been opposed to for many years, and it comes up whenever you get a Republican administration, and then it will go away, and then it will come up again. So I'm not sure what will happen, but if it's a refuge, it should be a refuge, and I don't think oil extraction is consistent with what was intended for that land.
Right. Kathy, thanks for the call, and have a great time. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point Bird News with Mark Faraday, science coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. 866-999-4626 is our number for your bird comments, questions, or stories. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And Irene is calling from Wellfleet. Hi, Irene.
Hi. I'm hoping that the last caller is still listening because I've spent a little bit of time in that area of Alaska where she's going, and I just wanted to make sure she keeps her eyes open for a marbled murrelet. Of all the animals and birds that I saw on that cruise, that murrelet was really impressive. It's a really small little seabird, but it sounds like she's also going to spend some time inland in the rainforest there, and part of the cool thing about that murrelet is that it nests up in those awesomely large trees with lots of moss on it, and anyway, they're really cool. I recommend that she watches for those.
Yeah, I concur, and this was a species whose nest was undescribed until it was like the 80s or maybe even more recently than that, but it was just a bird that we had no idea where they nested for decades and decades and decades, you know, after other birds' nests had been discovered, till somebody who worked for, I don't know if they were for a logging company or just a tree company, they were one of these people that shoots ropes way up into the giant trees in the Pacific Northwest rainforest and found this nest. and they nest on big horizontal limbs of these old growth trees in the temperate rainforest. Just bizarre for a seabird, a little seabird, like a puffin relative.
Or even more like a dovekie. I mean, they're really small. And that was what impressed me. I think I probably learned about the recent discovery of the nesting habitat before I actually saw the bird out on the water. I don't really remember which, but I was so impressed by their dual habitats. And they're really like little toy birds in the water. But they have that really cool habitat.
Irene, thanks for that suggestion. I'm sure Kathy.
I agree. They're both adorable and fascinating.
Yeah. All right. Melissa's thanks, Irene, for the call. Melissa's calling from West Falmouth. Hi, Melissa.
Good morning, Mindy. Hi, Mark. Thanks for doing the show. I love it. I love listening all the time. I have two questions for you. One of them is my chickadees at my bird feeder. I don't seem to have them anymore. And usually I have tons of them all over the place, and they don't seem to be here this fall. I'm wondering if it has anything to do with the warmth of this fall, or perhaps the fact that we trimmed back a couple of trees nearby, and I'm wondering if maybe do they feel more exposed sometimes around a bird feeder.
Or
and
could it
also
have...
another...
Okay, go ahead.
Second question, sorry. Could have sworn I saw something called an oven bird at my feeder the other day.
Reverse migration.
I heard you talking about the reverse warble migration, and I was wondering if that was what it was, because I'd never seen it before, and it was robin-sized and sort of a tawny brownish-reddish, and it had a very distinct circle around its eye.
Okay, you saw a hermit thrush. Oven bird is a warbler. They're a lot smaller than a robin, and they're sort of greenish on top, and they have stripes on their crown. You know, they're distinctive, but they are spotted underneath, and you could confuse them with a thrush. Hermit thrushes both breed here and will spend the winter, and occasionally you'll see them hopping around in your yard, but kind of rufous above, white underneath with black spots on the breast, a bit of an eye ring. They hop around on the ground, their tail's cocked up a little bit. Does that sound right?
This is definitely robin size, though. I mean, it didn't remind me of my Carolina ones.
Yeah, neither of those birds is robin size. They're both smaller, but a hermit thrush is closer to a robin in size.
And then the first question, she wants to know what happened to the chickadees.
Oh, what happened? This is the classic, I never have an answer for this. People always ask this. They call the sanctuary. Yeah. It's usually some local phenomenon. I actually don't have my feeders filled right now, so I can't comment on that. it's hard to say. I think they'll be back eventually.
There's still a lot of food around for them.
There's plenty of food out there for them. But it has gotten cold, and that's when you'd expect them to become regular at the feeders.
I wonder if Janet has a point there, though, with trimming back some trees. Because I know when I trim back the forsythia by my feeders, they don't, you know, the birds, we have less because they're going, woo, hawk can see me.
Yeah, they prefer to have cover pretty, you know, the closer to the feeders, the better. A feeder out in the middle of an open grassy area will never get the traffic that a feeder next to some good cover, some dense shrubs will get. So that, you know, that could also be part of it. You can try moving it.
Yeah.
Janet. Well, at least the shrubbery will grow back eventually. So
yes,
there you go.
That will help, I guess.
All right, thanks, Melissa. Janet sends an email. I saw a live ring-necked pheasant in Eastham on Saturday. He was running from the road into the woods. First time I've seen one in almost 20 years of living here.
Yes, I like that she says a live ring-necked pheasant, because you don't know, they're not going to be alive for long necessarily. So this is. It's been controversial out in the National Seashore for a while. There was a lawsuit, but the state still stocks ring-necked pheasants. They're raised on a game farm, and Mass Wildlife personnel put them in a truck and bring them to places like Sandy Neck in Barnstable, Hatches Harbor in Provincetown, and parts of the National Seashore in Wellfleet, by Duck Harbor. There are various places where they are released specifically to be hunted. Crane Wildlife Management Area, they release those, as well as Bob White's. So it's a Mass Wildlife program to benefit hunters, and it's certainly been controversial with, animal rights organizations that filed a lawsuit years ago. And I think the National Seashore will be gradually phasing it out, But the state will still release them other places like Sandy Neck and, you know, state wildlife Crane is a state wildlife management area, so they'll continue to release them there. But a male ring-necked pheasant, these are not native birds. These are birds that were brought here from Asia to be hunted. Mm. But there used to be more of them when there was more agricultural land. They do best in an agricultural landscape like in the upper Midwest. But, you don't see them as much anymore, but a male pheasant is a striking sight.
Yeah. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. So you mentioned you were in Peru.
Yes, I was perusing Peru.
Birding in Peru. So give us some highlights.
Oh, man. I was very, very lucky to be on this trip. It was what's called a fam trip, where the government and some of the local tourism companies in Peru wanted to promote birding in Peru. So it was a free trip, essentially, for several bird tour people. Like there were some bird guides from the UK, some folks from Italy, Canada. And so we were in the Amazon in the southern Peru, the basically tributaries of the Amazon, lowland jungle, some of the most diverse habitat in terms of species diversity in the world. Just mind-blowing place. Mm. Just the birds are unbelievable. And there's so many that the guides don't even know them all. The local guides.
Oh, the local guides. Wow.
Oh, they were stumped by certain things, and we're just sort of trying to figure things out together, looking at the book. There's too many. There are too many birds there for anybody to know them all. It's unbelievable. And so we started down there in the Madre de Dios district of southern Peru, which is, like I said, Amazon lowlands. Incredible things. Giant river otters, 5 feet away from a canoe. These things are like close to 6 feet long. Mm. Just munching on fish, all the different raptors, macaws, you know, scarlet macaws flying around. And then we headed up for a very big change up at 14,000 feet in the Andes at one point. But we headed up to Cusco and the Machu Picchu area, which people may know, the famous Incan ruins that has been many a Facebook profile picture, you know, selfie with Machu Picchu in the background. But that's all cloud forest, so higher elevation forest that's no less diverse. I mean, just hummingbirds and tanagers. The tanagers are just unbelievable. And they put these banana feeders out at the lodges and these just absurdly brightly colored little tanagers. There's so many different species come in to the feeders, and the hummingbirds are everywhere. The hummingbirds are frustrating. There are so many species, but they like to sit up in the canopy where they're backlit, and you're just trying to figure out what these things are. But there are dozens and dozens of different kinds of hummingbirds.
Must have been such a change.
Yeah, so I'm still in that, you know, just came back from my exotic trip. Do you want to hear about it? No, people don't. They have about a 30-second attention span.
No,
for
but
it,
I want to know, what excited you the most that you saw with all these great birds? Was there one that stands out that you were super excited to see?
Mm.
You're like, there's a lot.
No, there were so many. Yeah, I didn't have one target bird. There were some cool ones. Like there's one called the torrent duck. It's a beautiful duck that nests on these whitewater rivers. So if you ever have been to Machu Picchu or go, you take a train there, and the train runs through this just ridiculously gorgeous landscape of towering mountains and is along this rushing whitewater river. And you see these ducks sitting on the rocks, and so we were counting those as we went. And they somehow survive in these really rough whitewater streams full of rocks. Mm. So many different things. We saw the Inca wren. It's a target species up there at Machu Picchu. But just so many things.
You take a lot of pictures?
I took a lot of pictures. My camera broke on the first day, but I had a backup camera body that wasn't quite as good. I will be presenting this at Cape Cod Bird Club sometime during the winter, January or February.
That's a good time to be looking at birds in exotic places.
Yeah, warm birds. Yeah.
All right, so let's talk about what's migrating now.
What's migrating now? So, you know, November you might not think of as a big migration month, but like I always say, something is moving every month of the year. And November, there's a lot still happening. You know, songbird migration is pretty much over unless you're one of these poor warblers that get caught in reverse migration, ended up back here. But a lot of ducks are still on the move now, and certainly we see this being coastal. Long-tailed ducks are moving in now. We had reports of good numbers of them in Cape Cod Bay. And if you've it's never seen one.
Kind of weird the last few years. It hasn't been great numbers.
Yeah, it's something we're a little concerned about.
But it is quite an experience.
Yeah, I still haven't done it. I still haven't gone to Nantucket to see the long-tailed duck migration over the West End.
Yeah.
Not so much a migration, but a daily commute.
Yeah, it's wild. I mean, this was several years ago when I went with Vern, of course. And,
yeah.
It's like smoke in the sky. I mean, they're just, you couldn't even count them. There were so many.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
It's one of the great wildlife spectacles in the Northeast, really. Yeah. And I'm remiss in not having been there. But so they're coming in, and they're such a beautiful duck with that long tail and beautiful kind of black, white,
strong,
tan. Yeah, strong little ducks that eat kind of bigger zooplankton in the middle of the water column, and some shellfish, I think. So, and then the yalcids are starting to come in. So think razorbills, those kind of flying footballs, flying penguins of the north. one of my favorite groups of birds, they're coming in. You know, all of these things tell us that winter is here, but we appreciate our winter birds
as well.
So
not quite officially winter yet.
No, it's not. But you know, it felt like it when I got back from Peru and suddenly it's, you know, 32 degrees.
Yeah.
The razorbills are in. Golden eyes show up in November, beautiful ducks that are on both ponds and like salt bays. So keep an eye out for common golden eye and the odd Barrow's golden eye. Loons and grebes are still moving. Places like Race Point and Sandy Neck and places like this, you can see loons, both red-throated and common loons, migrating. and then there are some songbirds still. There's a November migrant that you can look for under your feeders. Maybe my favorite sparrow, the fox sparrow. Gorgeous, like bright reddish brown sparrow, big, like way bigger than a song sparrow, with dark black spots on the breast. And they act like a towhee. They sort of scratch in the leaf litter. They scratch around under the feeders. Look for them after cold fronts in November in under your feeders.
It sounds like a sparrow you might be able to identify. I have a tough time with the sparrows.
They're big. Yeah, they're big and red.
Yeah.
And there's some weird things we should keep a lookout for, like cave swallows. This is a bizarre thing that's only been happening the last 10 or 12 years, where cave swallows get brought up by southwesterly weather patterns from Texas and Mexico. They end up in the upper Midwest, and then cold fronts bring them to the coast, and they turn up at places like Chatham is a good place to see them, Nauset Beach. And it's a Mexican swallow that should not be here at all. And they come here, and they're not usually doing very well by the time they get here, especially if it's really cold. But this is the time of year, November, is when that happens. It's just when the weather patterns set up right. So look for those at places like Chatham Light, Nauset Beach, really anywhere along the coast. They're a beautiful swallow.
And we have like about a minute left.
Yeah,
so go ahead.
There's other weird things that turn up. If we do get cave swallows, you should be looking for things like ash-throated flycatchers, which come from the desert southwest. It's just amazing how many strange vagrants we get here on the Cape. And we get some interesting birds, too.
Yeah. And, of course, next month will be the bird counts, right?
That was a joke. next month is the Christmas bird count, so we're looking forward to that. The first weekend of December is the Cape Cod Waterfowl Census, which Blair Nicholas started many years ago, and it's now under the auspices of Cape Cod Bird Club. Make sure to go to the Cape Cod Bird Club website and check out future meetings and things like that. But also check out the Waterfowl Census. You can ask about volunteering on that. And so try to cover as many of the freshwater ponds on the Cape as possible. And we get a pretty good sampling of, you know, a few hundred, and just counting all of the ducks on all these ponds Cape-wide. So that's kind of a fun thing that first weekend in December. And then after that, a few weeks later, it's all about the Christmas bird counts that start around mid-December. So talk about those next month.
All right. We'll see you next month. Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. Thanks, Mark.
All right.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.